and when she opened the door, she found the far wall piled floor to ceiling with books. Old, new, all kinds of books. And at the sight of them, something in Kelsey loosened for the first time. She had seen more books today than in her entire lifetime in the Tierling, and surely a world with so many easily accessible books could not be so terrible. But still, something inside Kelsey, that dark twinge of warning, made her grab a battered volume from one of the piles and open it wide. Finding the pages covered with words, she breathed a sigh of relief. Everything she had seen around her today said that she had done it, achieved more for her small kingdom than she could ever have hoped for. Even Carlin would have been proud, if she had only known. But Kelsey did not need Carlin's praise any longer. The Tierling was safe, and Kelsey could be content with that. And for a while, she was. The more Kelsey saw of the new Tierling, the better it looked to her eyes. Perhaps it was not William Tier's unattainable dream come to life. There were still subtle gradations of wealth, and human nature made personal conflicts inevitable. But the community was extraordinarily open, with seemingly none of the corruption that had marked the Tierling or its neighbors. There was no traffic, not in drugs, or people, or anything else. If a man wanted to carry a weapon, there was no law against it. But Kelsey did not see so much as a single knife, except at the butcher shops. And violence appeared to be limited to the occasional fist fight, brought on by too much ale. Books were indeed everywhere, and the city boasted 6 different newspapers. There were no homeless, though some were wealthier than others. Doctors, in particular, commanded a good living. Everyone in the city was housed, fed, clothed, tended, and Kelsey heard none of the grumbling that had characterized the later years of the town. This baseline of care had been the true heart of William Tier's dream, the engine that had driven them all to board the ships, and it hummed merrily along here, unquestioned, enshrined in the community. Nor was New London the only such city. Replicas of William Tier's prototype now stretched across the new world, loosely governed by a parliament that seldom convened. There was no Mortmain, no Kader. Even if Evelyn Raleigh had once existed, she could never have become the Red Queen. In the days that followed, Kelsey visited the parliamentary building, which was seated not far from the old site of the Arvath, the University of New London, from which she herself had graduated not so long ago, and, last and most strange, the Tier Museum, a 2-room exhibit open to the public, which was housed near the old warehouse district. There, Kelsey listened to an over-enthusiastic tour guide tell the story of the crossing, of William Tier, who had led them across the ocean, of Jonathan Tier, who had been murdered by a traitorous advisor, Roe Finn. This advisor had been subsequently hacked to death by Jonathan Tier's guards, putting a quick end to his rebellion. Kelsey was only half listening. On the wall of the first room hung a row of portraits, many of which she recognized. William Tier, looking as though he would rather be anywhere else. Lily, in the field with her bow, looking backward, even though the future was still ahead of her, wide open. And Jonathan Tier, his face impassive, dark eyes dim with worry. Only the last portrait was new to Kelsey, and she hung back from the group, staring at the picture for a long while as the tour guide's bright, merry voice poured over her. "Caitlin Tier, first and only Queen of the Tierling, She ruled for a very long time, until the age of 77. The portrait was not the same one Kelsey had seen in the keep, not even close. This Caitlin Tyr was older, her face prematurely lined, her mouth taut. Her hair was still as long and lustrous as ever, hanging loose down her back. But she wore no crown. A forbidding woman, Kelsey thought, one who laughed very seldom, if ever. Queen Caitlin helped to write the Tyr Constitution, and many of our current laws come from the time of her reign. It took her more than 50 years to design and build the Tyr Parliament, but when she was 77, she finally handed over her government to Parliament and stepped down from the throne. The Tyrling hasn't had a monarch since. Kelsey absorbed this information quietly. It was not the ending she might have foreseen, but in hindsight, it made perfect sense. A constitution and a parliament. It seemed a marriage of the best of pre-crossing England and America. Katie might not have known that, but Lear would have. Lear, who was a student of history. Katie would have needed all five of them, Gavin and Howell, Lear and Alain and Morgan, all of them with their different gifts. Kelsey found that she liked that, liked the thought of the five of them, spending the next 60 years atoning for their crimes. Not many lifetimes, only one. It seemed fair. "Her jewels are still right here," the tour guide said breathily, indicating a display case that ran the length of the room. Kelsey peeked over her shoulder and saw them there. Two sapphire necklaces, lying on a field of blue velvet. Unreality washed over her, and she had to clutch the edge of the glass case for a moment before she backed away. When the tour ended, Kelsey followed the tour guide from the room, glancing uneasily back at the glimmer of sapphire in the sunlight. But it was already too late. Somewhere inside her, an alarm had gone off. The same alarm she had felt that first morning in the library. In her long history with these two jewels, they had always been double-edged. And though they no longer belonged to her, might never have belonged to her, they remained an uneasy reminder that nothing was easy. There was always a cost. And for the first time in many days, Kelsey thought of Mace, of her guard. Were they out there, somewhere? Some of them might never have been born. She had absorbed enough of Simon's talk on the butterfly effect to understand that. But if Carlin was alive, perhaps some of her guard might be too. Mace and Penn, Elston, Corin and Kib. She would give anything to see them again. But could she find them? As she emerged, blinking into the sunlight, and surveyed the broad horizon of the city before her, Kelsey felt daunted. It was a bigger world, this new London, and there was nothing comparable to the Queen's Guard. Swordcraft was not valued. Her guards might not stand out at all. But how could she not try? Something extraordinary had happened, a schism in the timeline of the world, and Kelsey suddenly realized that, more than anything, she had been longing for someone to talk to. Someone who had been there with her. She still remembered the past, and if she remembered, surely others would as well. Even if they didn't believe her about Katie and Roe and the rest of it, they could at least talk about the keep, about old times, about the world they all knew. 2 days later, she saw Pen. She was at the grocer looking for grapes, though it was early for them to be in season, when she caught sight of him, walking past just outside the window. Her heart gave a great leap, and she dashed out of the grocer, shouting his name. He did not turn around. He had a leather rucksack slung over his shoulder, and Kelsey followed the rucksack through the crowd, calling after him. He did not seem to hear her, and this made Kelsey wonder all over again if she were crazy, if this was only the most extensive and vivid dream anyone had ever had. Finally, she caught up with him and grabbed his shoulder. "Pen!" He turned and looked at her with no recognition at all.
"I'm sorry."
"Pen?" she asked uncertainly. "Isn't it you?"
"I'm sorry," he repeated. "But I think you've mistaken me for someone else. My name's Andrew."
Kelsey stared at him for a long moment. It was Pen in every detail. But he had a different name.
"I wish you a good day," he told her, patting her shoulder, and then turned and walked away.
Kelsey followed. She was not foolish enough to approach him again. The lack of recognition in his face seemed to have frozen her heart. But she could not just let him disappear, not once she had found him. Keeping well back, she followed him through several streets until he turned in at a small stone cottage set well back from the road. As he headed up the front steps, a door opened, and Kelsey saw a woman standing there, a pretty blonde woman with a baby balanced on one hip. Pen kissed her, and they went inside and shut the door. Kelsey stood for a long time, staring at Penn's house. She had never felt so alone in her life, not even in the cottage with Barty and Carlin. Barty, at least, had loved her. Perhaps Carlin had too, in her own way. But Pen did not know her. He had never known her. And now a truly horrible thought struck her. What if all of her guard were this way? What if all the people who had loved her, fought with her, taken care of her, would think of her as a stranger now? She had always told Mace that she would be willing to sacrifice anything for her kingdom, but here was a price she had never considered. Being alone. Eventually she turned her steps from Penn's cottage and forced herself to walk away, back toward home. She had been busy lately, preparing to move out of her mother's house and into a tiny flat closer to the library. It would be the first home she had ever had to herself, and the idea had thrilled her. But now, all of her bright pleasure in having a place of her own seemed as ersatz and meaningless as a rainbow. For a rogue moment, she wished she had died in the keep. At least then she would have had all of them around her. They would have been together. Twice more she went back to the Tyr Museum to stare at the glittering sapphires in their case. Even through glass, Kelsey's fingers itched to lay hold of them, to take the jewels and reset everything, even wreck the kingdom if it came to that, if only she could have her life back again. Her family around her. She had not returned to the museum for a fourth visit, but it didn't matter. The damage was already done. Over the next few weeks, without even meaning to, Kelsey began to ask her colleagues at work if they had ever met a man named Christian. She had thought it would be a common enough name, but it turned out not to be. There were few churches in New London, and at any rate the name seemed to have fallen out of favour, even among the devout. Kelsey didn't know why she was looking for Mace. Even if she found him, it could only mean a repeat of the same terrible scene she'd had with Penn. But she felt that she had to know. Some of her God had never been born, perhaps, but some of them might still be out there. And knowing that, Kelsey could not leave it alone. It turned out that even in this New London, Mace cut a recognizable figure. It took Kelsey only a few inquiries to discover that a man named Christian McAvoy was the head of the city constabulary. This Christian McAvoy was a big man, well over 6 feet tall, and he was generally considered an excellent police officer. Hard, but fair. You didn't want to lie to the man, for he would always know. For 2 weeks, Kelsey dithered. She wanted to see him, but did not want to see him. She was drawn to the idea, yet terrified. But in the end, she went. She went on her lunch break from the library, taking a taxi wagon across town. She would not bother Mace, she told herself. She only wanted to see him. It would do her good to see him, to know that he truly existed, that he, like Penn, was happy in this new place, that Kelsey had done him some good. She did not want to disrupt his life. She only wanted to see him. But when the time finally came, when the tall man with Mace's face emerged from the police station and looked straight through Kelsey as though she didn't exist, she knew that she had made a terrible mistake. All of the strength left her limbs. She was standing just across the street, on the stairs of the building opposite the station, and as Mace hurried down the street, she collapsed onto the stairs, burying her head in her hands. "I remember them all. I remember them all, but they don't remember me. They never will." The idea was so hopeless that Kelsey began to weep. She had bargained for this, she told herself. She had done a great thing, an important thing, more important than any one life. Her kingdom was now a thriving economy, with open trade and a free flow of information. The Tierling had laws, codified laws, and a judiciary to enforce them. Church had been cleaved from state. The kingdom was dotted not only with bookstores, but with schools and universities. Every worker earned a living wage. People raised their children without fear of violence. It was good, this country. And all Kelsey had been forced to trade for it was everything. She suddenly remembered yelling at the fetch, telling him that he had deserved his fate, to watch all of those he knew and loved die around him. She hadn't known, hadn't understood. She sobbed harder, so lost that at first she didn't feel the gentle hand on her back. "Are you all right, my child?" Kelsey wiped her eyes, looked up, and saw Father Tyler. "It's all right for you to be here," he assured her, mistaking her look of alarm. "God's house is open to all, especially the grieving." "God's house," Kelsey murmured. She hadn't even noticed the tiny cross on the roof of the building behind her. Father Tyler's face was pale, but not the thin, starved pallor that Kelsey remembered. She would wager that this Father Tyler was no longer an ascetic. He bore little resemblance to the timid, frightened creature of the Arvath.
"Would you like to come inside?"
he asked.
"Even for a few minutes, to get out of the sun?"
Kelsey did want to, but she knew that she could not. Father Tyler treating her as a stranger as well, it would be more than she could bear. "God's house is not for me, Father," she said heavily. "I am not a believer."
"And I'm not a father," he replied, smiling. "I'm just a brother. Brother Tyler. This is my church."
"What is your church called?"
"It has no name."
Father Tyler, she could not think of him as brother, replied.
"Parishioners come whenever they want. I give sermons on Sundays. Sometimes we go out and do good works."
"Bully for you," Kelsey muttered uncharitably. She would have given her entire world to see Father Tyler, but all she was left with was Brother Tyler, a smiling man of God who didn't know her from Adam.
"Who do you grieve for?"
he asked. "It doesn't matter."
"Of course it does."
He sat down beside her, wrapping his arms around his knees. Kelsey would have wagered house and lot that he no longer suffered from his terrible arthritis, and wondered how that miracle had been achieved. But of course, the Tierling was now full of doctors. Central New London even had a hospital.
"Have you lost a loved one?"
Kelsey hiccuped laughter, for it was somehow worse than loss. Everyone around her continued, oblivious, happy in this new world. She had not been left alone so much as left behind, and she could not imagine a loneliness more vast.
"Tell me, Father," she asked. "Have you ever met someone who lost their entire life?"
"Yes, but never someone so young as you. And that makes it a tragedy."
"What do you mean?"
"How old are you, child?" 18? 19?
19.
"Well, there it is. You're a healthy young woman. You are healthy, aren't you?"
Kelsey nodded.
"You're a healthy young woman, with your whole life ahead of you, and yet you sit here weeping for the past."
"I've already lived my life."
But Kelsey did not say it. She had not burdened Penn or Mace with the past they could not know. She would not burden Father Tyler, either.
"The past colors everything," she told him. "Surely a man of God and history knows that."
"How do you know I'm a man of history?"
"A guess," Kelsey replied wearily. She was in no mood for this, for tiptoeing around a man she had once known well, pretending not to know him at all. She lifted her bag onto her shoulder. "I have to go, Father."
"A moment more, child."
His keen gaze swept over her.
"You've lost everything, you say?"
"Yes."
"Then look around you."
He swept an arm before him.
"All these people. Surely you should be able to find something new to care about."
Kelsey blinked, alarmed at the optimism in his words. How could anyone possibly be that resilient?
Your advice is good, Father, she finally replied. But it's advice for someone else. I thank you for the place to rest.
Of course, child.
He waved toward the building behind him.
You are welcome at any time to come back and talk.
Thank you. But Kelsey knew she wouldn't return, and she didn't look back as she descended the church steps. She still felt slightly dizzy, as though the ground had been yanked from under her. All of these things that are gone now. Where did they go? Are they still out there somewhere? She wished she had not come to the police station. Only pain had awaited her there, just as she had known it would. Even Mace was lost to her now.
Surely you must be able to find something new to care about.
But what could that be? She had already achieved her life's great work. She had saved the Tearling, and now she was no longer a queen, only an ordinary young woman. There were no more heroics to be done. What could she possibly do as Kelsey Raleigh? She liked her job at the library. She loved her little flat. Was that everything? How could it not be an empty life, after watching kingdoms rise and fall? There are upsides, too, her mind remarked in a flat, dry voice that Kelsey recognized as Anderlei's. No one wants to murder you now, do they? You haven't killed anyone yourself. You've been cruel to no one. True. The Queen of Spades, the shadow of vengeance that had fallen over Kelsey almost from the moment she had taken her throne, she was gone, buried in the distant past. Kelsey could feel her absence, like a splinter that had been withdrawn, and she felt certain as she could be of anything in this new world, that the Queen of Spades would never trouble her again. There was gain there, great gain, perhaps, but Kelsey did not trust herself to see it clearly. The past stood in the way. At the junction of the Great Boulevard, now called Queen Caitlin's Road, Kelsey climbed down from the wagon and began the slow walk back to work. Checking her watch, she was relieved to see that she had plenty of time. She had not been late again since that first morning, and Carlin had stopped checking her watch when Kelsey walked in the door, which was a relief. Carlin had not changed in the slightest. Kelsey wanted her approval badly, but Carlin was going to make her earn every inch. Just like old times. Kelsey felt tears threatening again and walked faster. But beneath the tears, Father Tyler's words beat against her brain.
Your whole life ahead of you.
She wished this idea would simply go away. To let go of the unrecoverable past and attempt to grasp a future. That would take courage. Far more than she possessed, the past was too much a part of her.
You've got guts, Queenie, Arliss whispered in her head.
That was true. She had always had guts. But what she needed now was a concussion. How could she forget everything and start again, here, in this normal life? She turned up the library walk, miserably aware that she was crying again. She dug in her bag, but she hadn't even been smart enough to remember a handkerchief. There was worse to come. Carlin was on the library porch, sitting in one of the chairs. She liked to eat her lunch outside when the weather was cool, and so the rest of the staff generally avoided the porch on principle. Kelsey tried to walk past as quickly as possible.
Kelsey?
Murmuring a curse inside her head, Kelsey turned back.
What's happened to you?
Carlin asked.
Nothing, Kelsey replied, ducking her head. And in that moment she realized that it could almost be true. Nothing had happened. Nothing real outside her head. But could she ever accept that? She wiped her streaming eyes, then jumped as she felt Carlin's hand on her shoulder. Of all of the odd moments Kelsey had experienced in the past weeks, this was perhaps the most unsettling. There was no tenderness in Carlin, never had been. She never touched anyone except to discipline, but now, the hand on Kelsey's shoulder did not pinch. And when she looked up, she found that Carlin's stern, lined face was kind. Astonished, Kelsey suddenly realized that in this new Tierling, anything could be different, even Carlin Glynn could change. Become someone else.
Kelsey?
Swallowing her tears, Kelsey took a deep breath and squared her shoulders. She was not a queen, but a normal girl, a good citizen of the Tierling, her kingdom, which no longer needed saving, which had been made whole.
Kelsey? Where have you been?
This is Polly Lee. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of The Fate of the Tierling by Erica Johansson. This program was produced by John Marshall Media. Executive producer, Katie Ostroker. Text copyright 2016 by Erica Johansson. Production copyright 2016 by HarperCollins Publishers. All rights reserved. Thank you for listening.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.